Skirted Roundtable. I'm Linda Merrill from Surroundings.
And this is Megan Arquette from Beach Bungalow 8.
And this is Joni Webb with Coke to Texas.
And this week on the Skirted Roundtable, we are welcoming someone a little bit different for our guests. We're welcoming Jane Pollock, who is a motivational speaker and has re-released her book, which I actually read on its first release in 2001. It's called Sole Proprietor, 101 Lessons from a Lifestyle Entrepreneur. And we are going to be talking about what exactly is a lifestyle entrepreneur. I thought this would be, Jane would be a particularly interesting guest for our listeners because we have so many people who are crafters, which is Jane's background, bloggers, designers, self-employed, wannabe self-employed, creative, entrepreneurial people. So, Jane, thank you so much for joining us at the Skirted Roundtable.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Linda. Thank you for having me.
So, as we do with everybody, we want to hear what your background is, and you do have a very interesting, your craft is a very interesting and unique one. So, why don't we start with what your craft is that brought you to kind of the stepping stone to what you're doing now?
Well, 100 years ago in 1973, I learned the craft of Ukrainian Easter egg decorating. I was a high school art teacher, and one of the other art teachers showed me this and said we were going to do it with our students. And she opened up a dozen of these amazing designs, and I went home that night and I made the first one, and I was addicted immediately. Did my first craft show that summer, did another craft show the next summer, started teaching workshops, and got an invitation to do an egg for the White House. I did a workshop for Bloomingdale's. I started to get recognition right away, still continued to teach, and then had children, but I kept my finger in. And I like to say that I said I would keep my pinky fingernail in because I would do a little something and people would say, are you still doing the eggs? So as my kids grew and I had three children, I would do occasional craft shows, occasional workshops, really focusing on my children, which was my highest value, still is. When my youngest went to kindergarten, I had been spending a lot of time volunteering, and I thought, I'm going to take that time and really put it into my business. So I increased the number of shows from 2 or 3 a year to 8 or 10 a year, and really was becoming quite successful out of this very niche market. In addition to doing the eggs, people would say to me, will you teach a course on how to get PR? Because I would get enormous press, I think because what I did was so unusual. And I would be in the New York Times, and I got on the Today Show. And so I realized that I was doing the art and also speaking about it. So the morphing of my business, which lasted 30 years, was purely as an artist. Then I was Jane the artist, Jane the speaker. Once I started to have a public platform, people would say, gee, can I pick your brain? Can I spend an hour with you? Can my sister call you? She has a similar business. And I realized that I was coaching. And that industry hadn't even started until I was in my own business for a good 15 or 20 years. But then I realized, you know what, I was born to be a coach. I took certification courses and the whole background fundamentals courses in coaching and got certified in 2007 as a professional co-active coach, certified professional co-active coach, which is what I've been doing. I've been actually coaching since 2002. So for me, the process of morphing, it was very organic. It all came, the speaking came out of all the time I was working on my eggs, which was very solitary. I was listening to motivational speakers and people telling me how to run a business. And I thought, I want to do that. I want to help other people. And that's exactly what I've come to do.
Well, as I said at the beginning, the first time I heard you speak was actually the very first when I started my business. I was still working in the old life job, and went to my very first business networking event, and you were the speaker, and that was, I'd seen it listed in the paper, and I thought, well, this is exactly what I'm looking to do, try to, you know, make a career out of a creative endeavor. And you were talking about your eggs, and you were still selling, you were selling your little earrings. You made really cute earrings,
yes,
out of cracked eggs, which I bought, and I promptly lost one, which is the story of
very valuable now, Linda.
See, it's the story of my life with jewelry. So one of the stories I remember you talking about, and I think a lot of us, particularly now with blogging, we get a little bit of attention. You know, you suddenly get more attention than you might have gotten if we weren't blogging. Mm-hmm. And I always really remembered your story of, like, your visit to the White House. And I was wondering if you could sort of recount that for us a little bit.
Well, I got, part of this is about humility. I got an invitation. I think that was the first time I went. I actually received four invitations to go to the White House, but we were told, the invitation came and it said that you were invited to the White House. It was by the Reagans, and I decorated an egg for the White House, and would I also attend the event? And then these eggs were going to become part of the Smithsonian collection. So it was a huge recognition. So they said that our names would be on a special list and we had a special entrance to go through. And I thought, it's just going to be me, my husband, our three kids, and Nancy and Ron. You know, what a great invitation. So we went down to Washington. I live in Connecticut. And, we stayed over the night before, and the morning comes and we hail a cab, and I say, the White House. And the cab driver just kind of rolled his eyes like, oh, no, not another one. I'm thinking, no. I have a special invitation. I have a special entrance. And he dropped us off at our special entrance. We got checked off the special list, and we joined the 30,000 other special guests of the White House. It was a mass scene. And, at one point my husband, our daughter was, sobbing hysterically. We're waiting on some long line. He goes, gee, Jane, you're really special. So it was, me and 29,000 other people. Now, they hadn't all decorated eggs, but, the credential stayed, but the experience was not quite what I had hoped for, which happens a lot.
Did they use your eggs ever for Christmas at the White House?
Okay, those were Easter, and they were on display, so there was a special display, which we got to see, and my name was there, and the state I was with, and all that. And then those eggs actually went to the Reagan White House, or Reagan Museum in Simi Valley, California. Somebody actually had toured it, and they said, I saw your eggs. So the Smithsonian incorporates anything that a president is in a presidential library is all considered part of the Smithsonian. So yes, they were there, and I get the credential of my eggs in the Smithsonian. But it's not like having your work in the Metropolitan on display. It's a little different, but that's okay because perception is everything.
Yeah, I don't think I'd turn that down, especially.
Yeah, well, that was the other funny thing is I get the call. They said, this is the White House. Would you consider decorating an egg for the Easter egg roll? And I was like, yeah, I'll consider it. Yes. Okay, I'm in. But it was truly a life-changing phone call because it was really getting recognition from something that everybody knew the name of. And that's key. That's why you want to have celebrity endorsement or a name of something that's recognizable in your industry behind you, because it holds tremendous credibility. Everybody would say, oh, this is Jane. She has eggs at the White House, or her eggs are in the Smithsonian. I didn't use the credential. I mean, I used it in my marketing, but other people would say it about me far more often.
Well, right. You're not going to walk up to people and say it. Hi, I'm Jane. My eggs are in the Smithsonian.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think it was just, it always struck me as such a, it should have, it was portentous for me listening to that before I had any, done anything. And, it's just that on and off and on and off. Highs and lows. You think this thing is it, and then it's like, oh, that wasn't so much it.
There's one of my lessons in the book is the Big Nothing. The Roche sisters are a singing group, and they were supposed to be on Johnny Carson. They were on Johnny Carson, and they thought, this is it. The phone is going to ring off the hook. Nothing happened. Nothing happened as a result of that. And they wrote a song called The Big Nothing. And I thought, what? That happens a lot. We have these expectations, and then a very small thing will happen that you take a lot of pride in, and it feels really good, and amazing things happen. So it's part of being an entrepreneur and a sole proprietor is riding the highs and lows, because you never know. So you just keep showing up with your heart open and your, optimism in check.
That's interesting, because when you have a house printed in a design magazine, you think your phone's going to start ringing off the hook with people wanting to hire you. And when mine was in the magazine twice, once in a national publication, I got nothing. I mean, nothing from it. Not even a phone call.
You know what they say? It's not, and this is true of life, but it's true of publicity. It's not what happens to you. It's what you do with what happens to you. So when I started getting publicity, my first spread was in Country Home Magazine. and I had a two-page spread with my eggs, and it was quite sensational. And so what I did was I took the cover and those two pages, and I made a triptych, and I framed it. And every time I went to a craft show, I hung it in my booth, and people would say, oh, she's the one who. But I could have just let that sit there. So it's what you do with that. How did you capitalize on that publicity? Did you send it to all your existing customers? Did you frame it? Did you do email blasts about it? You know, I think a lot of people think just having that is enough, and it's not. It's then you use that as the vehicle to take it to the next level.
Which is why, I mean, a lot of bloggers, myself included, will put stuff on their blogs, you know, like links to where they've been and what publications. And I think that it's how, I mean, it's why not? You know, why not? Draw attention to it. Why not? You're your own PR person. You're building all these little, every little bit is a building the foundation. And I think backing all this, the one thing, and you sort of talk about this, is the passion for whatever it is you're doing. That passion will not make the hard work and the time that's required feel so hard and so laborious.
A friend of mine said recently, he said, you know, people say, well, how do you deal with clients or how do you do this? He said, well, caring really helps. You know, you can't manufacture that. And if if you're a blogger and you're really enthusiastic about showing things to people, the other people will pass around. They say, well, that's a really cool image. Let me show that to my group. And that's the viral quality of it, which we used to have to do it by putting stamps on letters or something. You know, it can spread so much faster. The downside is that there's so much more out there, but our job is to be passionate about it and say, this is what interests me. And hopefully you create your own community of people who will then pass it on and pass it on. You just never know. But I love what you said, Megan, is that it's your passion that is the fuel for all of it.
I confess, I really did nothing besides frame the stories for my office. I never really did what you said, you know.
It's never too late, Joni. It's never too late. You can do it now. You say, you know, it could have been 6 years ago. You can put it out and, you know, it still holds value.
Now, you put it on your blog, though, didn't you, Joni?
Well, I mean, yeah, on my blog. But I will tell you that there are designers who have made careers out of cover stories, you know. They've gotten these fabulous jobs from a story in a magazine. I mean,
my take on it is that it's all of the above. So you get the press, you're out there networking, you do great work, you use the press, you blog, you send email newsletters, you do all of that. So it isn't just one thing. So you had some press, you know, you have to do 20 more things. So this person is doing it all, and also got a little bit lucky because it's, you know, being there at the right time in the right place. So, but it's all of it. You know, I have clients who will say, well, I sent out a mailing. It's like, yes. And, you know, there's no stopping when you're an entrepreneur. Think of how many L.L. Bean catalogs you get, you know, or used to get. I think that it's all faded a little bit now. But every week you were getting one, right. So, you know, telling
them.
Well,
now we get emails like that.
There you go.
It's about, you know, and I remember reading some silly statistics somewhere that said a minimum of 3 requests is required before someone actually, generally, on average, will hear you and go, oh, this person's asking something of me.
Yes.
You know,
pick your own behavior. You know, it takes me a while. Well, I'll just get another, you know, I'll get another invitation, then I'll respond. And then usually I wait until a day or two before. Unless there is a, you know, a call to action that says the first 10 people or deadline by, I don't act. You know, so look at your own behavior and then notice what you put out and what your expectations are.
Well, remember catalogs, they would send you one and say, you haven't bought something in a year and we're never going to send you another catalog until you buy something.
It's like parking tickets. I don't pay mine until the city sends me and says, we're going to pop this up another $30 if you don't pay it by now. Okay, I will. Okay, I got it.
Right. So, Jane, explain to us your definition of a lifestyle entrepreneur.
I've heard a great definition. I heard these women speak at it was a Ladies Who Launch event. And they had bought a business, you know, they had looked, these were two women, they had run big companies, and they bought something with the sole purpose of selling it in the future, like building it up, getting the clientele, developing new product, and selling it. A lifestyle business, a lifestyle entrepreneur does something in my book that they're passionate about, that it fits into their life, that they would do no matter what, and they figure out a way to make it work for them rather than them working for it. And to me, a lifestyle entrepreneur is somebody who is really passionate and loves what they do as opposed to a, you know, somebody who's just looking to sell a business. And what I noticed was these women were not particularly happy. I didn't enjoy any of their stories. I thought I would rather slit my throat than do what they're doing. I love every day of my business because it's about what I love doing. So it's where you work, your business works for you rather than you working for your business. And the bottom line is measured not only in dollars, because I certainly believe in profitability, but also in quality of life.
I was thinking as you were talking about Martha Stewart and how she's kind of, you know, certainly started out as a lifestyle entrepreneur, but I'm not sure, based on that definition, she could still be that person because, you know, it is, or maybe she could, because maybe her business can never be anything without her.
Well, I think she really is kind of the quintessential lifestyle entrepreneur. It grew out of all of her loves, and she's, you know, she's an empire. And Oprah, too. Well, Oprah is more of a journalist, I guess. But certainly Martha Stewart. And that doesn't say that I like everything that she's done or I want to be her, because I don't want a $1 billion business. It's huge. And that's not, I'm not looking for employees or that kind of payroll. But I, you know, you have to examine what your values are. And my value is to keep my life uncomplicated, to do work that I love, to be appreciated for what I do, to have time for family and friends. She has a different set of values, and that's, you know, wonderful. I really appreciate and admire what she does. But yes, she's definitely taken what she's loved to the, you know, to its highest degree, for sure.
One of the things that I, when looking at your book, thought was something to jot down, your concept of value, having writing down, I think you had three points that, you know, you always sort of measured jobs against. Is it going to make my life complicated? Is it, you know, is it going to, just all the different, your values, as you called them. So I always thought that was really, you know, something that I guess I did without realizing it. And I think it's really important. When I started a new business that was home staging, I did it because I knew it'd be something I could get in and out of and do it quickly and finish up a job. And I had very young children and I was a single mother. So for me, it was like easy money, quick job. That's what I need it to be. Little stress in case, you know, interior design wasn't, you know, giving me jobs all the time. And so, you know, and it worked. That's how I set it up. I'd never done it before, but I found a partner to help me because I knew there'd be times where I couldn't do it. She also had young children, so she'd be able to understand. And often we'd say, well, we can't do it because we have a sick kid, and that's part of why we're doing this business, because we're trying to work and take care of little tiny ones. So I think
that's like it worked for you and that you got satisfaction out of what you could do. And like you, my business, as my children grew, my business grew. As I was able to travel, I did shows further away, or I took speaking opportunities further away. So that's, you know, I remember when I was working with a coach and I said, oh, you know, this guy called me and, you know, I just, we just didn't seem to connect and I feel like I lost a client. She said, who is your ideal client? And I said, well, a woman. It was like, you know, it wasn't, I forgot what my template was, what my, you know, what my screens were for accepting the work. And I think we're much happier when we decide, you know, I need something that allows me all these things that I truly value. And that's when you really are thriving, when you can respect that and have your clients respect it too.
Well, and that way, you know, I really believe that not every client is for you. You get very excited, especially you're a single mom, you're starting a business, you want success, you want clients. So you start in the beginning going, sure, I'll take that job. I'll figure it out. And then once we got more confident in what we were doing, it was like, no, that's really not a job we want. You know, this client seems to be a little difficult. And frankly, I've got somebody with a fever at home and somebody else who's teething. So really, I don't want that. You know, and so we were able, because we knew, like you said, what kind of client we would work with. Not everyone was for us. And we were expensive. So again, not everyone was for us. But we knew what we were.
You know,
we knew what we were giving to them was a higher quality than most people, most stagers. So
exactly. You're happier. They're happier. You're not, you know, we're not for everybody. I remember going to a lecture years ago and they said, who is your ideal client? And somebody said, women ages, you know, 10 to 100 or something. They said, what are you, Sears? You know, you can't really serve that kind of population. So the more specific you are, the more you allow the universe to send you the right people. And as you say no to difficult clients, difficult personalities, or people that don't fit that, you know, that structure that you've created, the more you're saying to the universe, this is what I want, this is what I deserve, and the more those people will get funneled to you. So it's kind of like The Secret, you know, if you know exactly what you want, that law of attraction brings it to you.
I was actually had marked down that same lesson, Megan, which is lesson 6, truly understanding your core values, because what it made me think of, and exactly what you said, was particularly when you start a business and you're holding out your hand needing to be paid, because you do actually have to pay bills, is you sort of feel like you have to take everything. And often we're told we have to take everything. Take everything, take everything. You never know where it will lead. And it's so hard to know that fine line between the you never know where it will lead and it's not...
a waste of time.
It's a waste of time. It's not within your core values.
You can, if I think that when you get in, and I've done this only once, I've gotten into, without going with my instinct of going, this isn't going to work, red flag, personality alert, you know, I have gone into it and then partway through it said, you know, I don't think that we're a good match and I think I'm going to have to, you know, move on. I think this has been, I just sort of end the relationship with the client because as you get into it, you realize this was a mistake. That's probably not the best match.
That's such an important thing to be able to have in your business, the ability to say, no, I've fired clients and I fired people from groups that I'm in. And I do the same thing. I just said, you know, is this working for you? Because it really isn't working for me. And I think I have somebody I can refer you to or another situation because it's miserable. A friend of mine calls it the uh-oh feeling. And I think our guts know. Our guts always know what's right and what's not right for us.
You know, what I was going to say is the photographer that we had on, Michael Lee, remember, y'all, he stressed that one of the biggest interior designers in Boston, I believe, had told him never, ever, ever turn down a job, no matter how small it is.
Yes.
Because you never know where it's going to lead. Remember that?
Yeah.
He said that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I know, it's so hard to know, because that I really liked that mantra as well, and that has made Michael, instructed how Michael has created his business, which is take the small jobs, create something that makes the small jobs, but he makes those small jobs work for him.
And I think that there's some unspoken things that are also in there. I think that he wouldn't, for instance, maybe take a small job that was, a wedding in a church basement where they had $100 for
right.
the entire budget.
Right.
And they wanted to do, what would that have to do with anything? That doesn't have to do with where he wants to go. It doesn't have, he'll never get exposure. I think that, you know, in interior design, I'll take a job if it's someone just needs paint colors chosen. Heck yeah, I'll take it. But I probably won't take the job from the woman who has a budget of under $1,000 and she needs her entire condo and I get there and there's 20 cats running around and, you know, there are blankets for curtains on the wall. I'm not going to take that job. Small job, I'll take a small job that has the possibility to get bigger. But you know that innately. That's another one of those I think we all know innately.
Yeah, but it's hard when you have that initial meeting to turn it down afterwards, I've found. So I try to suss it out on the phone call.
Oh, yeah. If you can nip it in the bud then, you don't waste your time going over there.
Once I'm in the house, it's like, oh, you know.
You want to get your hands on it and help them.
No, it's just hard to walk away from it.
Right. Now, I think.
Why, you feel like you're going to let them down?
You know, I have a thing about hurting people or saying no, you know, so,
Jane, what do you have to say about that? Was there anything in
your
book about being afraid to say no?
You want to qualify your prospects. So for instance, one of the things I have some design clients and I say, you know, that you have a fee to go out to their house. And if they're not willing to do that, then they may not be a serious enough client for you. I put my prices on my website because I want people to know that in order to start coaching with me, there's a $400 discovery session, and then the sessions begin. So there's that that hurdle that people have to go over. And I'm not for everybody, and I don't pretend to be for everybody. I do have entry into access to me. They can come to a networking event for $50. They can buy my book for $15. But I don't make myself available to everybody at the level that I make myself available to my, you know, my clients who can afford to pay that and who who find the value in what I do.
And that's setting it up powerfully. You're setting it up powerfully for those people to have realistic expectations of you And so you don't even have to deal with it because it's the law, the rules are all sitting out there for them to choose. Do I want this or not?
My tagline is I lead remarkable women to uncommon success. So already people who call me are self-evaluating as remarkable, which is what I want. I want people who have the self-esteem to say, I fit into that category, or I want to be in that category. But if people are afraid to call me, you know, there are certain hurdles I don't want to help people over. So if they're too afraid for that, then they have to reach a certain developmental level before I want to work with them, because that's just what I choose to do because of, you know, the nature of my business. I could have structured my business for people who are just beginning to consider entrepreneurship. But for me, that's not where I want to put my energies. So we get to decide and define. That's another part of lifestyle entrepreneur. I create what I want in my business. And that's delightful for me. And fortunately, I find matches of people who want what I have to offer.
And that flows into, I had noted, lesson 15, which is, as difficult as it is, you can teach yourself to believe you deserve what you charge for your work. And then lesson 24, get comfortable asking for the money. And I kept thinking, you know, we do always sort of hit our heads against the men versus women approach to that. And I know you consult for women. Do you think we still are having this issue of women are afraid to ask more so than men?
I absolutely do. And I think it's, you know, it's a muscle that needs to get flexed. I studied with a coach who I imitated her thing. She said, you know, this is my charge. I get your credit card at the beginning of every month. Your card will be charged. I didn't have to worry about people sending me a check. And it's all very out in the open and up front. And I have no problem when somebody does my, I do something called a Dream Peak experience. I'll say, let's get the business out of the way. What is your credit card number? Because that I charged on the phone for that one call. So it's really, you have to get comfortable with it first. And if you're afraid to ask, people pick that up. You know, it's like they can smell it. They smell the fear like an animal. And it's a very uncomfortable subject for a lot of people. The more comfortable you are with it, the more comfortable your client is with it, because it's not secretive. It's just out there in the open.
Before I left my job to self-employ myself, I had wanted to go part-time and sort of ease my way in. And I was talking to a guy who was head of one of our big departments in the division that I worked. And he was just someone who just did it. He just asked for things. He went and did things. It didn't even occur to him to be worried about asking the question. And when I was talking to him and hemming and hawing, and he was like, you know, about how I was going to broach our boss about going part-time, because I didn't have the best relationship with my boss at the time. And he was like, Linda, don't even tell him. Just don't come. He's not here all the time. Just don't come in. And I was just like, that's such like almost like a guy response. Just go and do it and figure it out.
Yeah, but it's, you know, different hang-ups. I think women are so sensitive about how they're going to be perceived. But again, if you're comfortable with it, people actually admire that. It's like, you know, her prices are up there. She's straightforward about it. It takes all the ick out of it.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, when things are covert or you don't know what your prices are. You know, I help a lot of people with pricing because it's such a big issue. And it's really just saying it. I had one client who does, you know, amazing artwork. And I said, I want you to actually say these are your prices. And I want you to say it out loud 100 times so that when we speak next time, you just say, I charged, you know, $175 to come to your house, blah, blah, blah. So that it's not, because as soon as you start hearing that hesitation, it makes you uncomfortable as the client or prospect. And then everything kind of goes to seed after that. So you want to be really comfortable with it. And it's just rehearsing like an actress.
My worst experience with that was I had a client that I spent a lot of time on for nothing, you know, like pillows, you know, that kind of thing where you spend hours and hours and show them thousands of fabrics. And so my fee is 20% over cost, you know, which is pretty cheap, and no hourly rate. And I made her, I had a custom made leatherette ottoman, huge round ottoman tufted made for her. And she knew my price. And when I went to bill her, you know, she said, well, how much do I owe you? And I said, well, it's 20%. And she said, I don't really think that you deserve that because the cushion was, the ottoman was, you know, like $2,000. And I don't think you did $400 worth of work.
It's not up to her. That's where you.
Megan, I was so angry.
Sure.
You know, and I just looked at her and I said, you know what? Forget it. You know, you just keep the, you know, I'm so insulted. I mean, what do you say to someone like that? And it was like out of pride. I said, just keep your money. She goes, no, I'll pay you 10%.
There's a loss of power for you.
Yeah, it's a business transaction, and I'm hearing a lot of emotion in there, and I think you want to really keep it separate. And a lot of the things, you know, if you reduce your transactions to writing to say, this is what it is, sign off on this, then there's no question and it's not negotiable. And also collecting money up front, like, you know, like your lawyer would get a retainer, you would get, you know, $500 up front or whatever that applies to it. I remember hearing Roger Dawson say he was on the golf course and some kid had collected, you know, old golf balls that he had found, and they had lost their last golf ball. And they see the kid with his egg carton and all these golf balls. And on the top of the carton, it said, golf balls, $2 each. Now, you know, golf balls probably at the time were 25 cents each, but because it was in writing, they couldn't argue with him, even though he was like a 10-year-old kid. So it's really about, you know, getting it established and then just standing behind it and not letting personalities come into it, because she just hardballed you, and that wasn't fair.
Joni, I think that that's like one of those things where having that contract, so it's almost like it's the law of your business. It's not you personally. You know, you mm-hmm. set it up and say, this is what you're going to be charged, and it's going to cost this, this, and this. So, you know, and when you sign off, it's yours, so that she doesn't come back 2 months later and say, I don't like it. I want my money back.
Yeah, but it was just so insulting to be told that
it
to
is.
Your face. I don't think
it
what
is.
He did was worth 20%. Well,
and that's not her place to see it. She should have made that decision before she got into that contract, you know, in parentheses with you.
Trust me, it was the last thing I ever did for her.
Well, that's,
I
mean, that's the thing about our business is we, you know, it's the fire your client. If someone does that to you, you can just walk away, cut your losses and say, that's it, you know, and learn from it.
Yeah, I was going to say, a friend of mine calls it tuition.
Right. I think everybody, everyone in business has the story of the client that, you know, the communication they didn't make quite as clear, or the client that takes advantage of them, and you just either walk away or you storm away, or, you know, you maybe think back and say, how could I have handled it better? And then you learn from it. I liked, Jane, your lesson 72, which is the success story of someone who has traveled the route before you can help you stay on course. And actually, I was thinking that's a lot of what we try to do with the Skirted Roundtable, because we've had, you know, designers who have just enormous acclaim that we're, you know, breathless to speak to them. And I think we all have just sat there listening to them because everybody has their story.
Everybody does. And it's so reassuring because, you know, when you see somebody who's on the cover of something, that's all you're seeing. But there's, you know, it's like the swan swimming or the Bolshoi ballerina. They're working so hard to get there. None of it happens by accident, and everybody who has made it to a place of recognition has incredible war stories and scars to show for it.
I had lesson 86, which is pursue your goals systematically, and you will get where you want to go, but not necessarily the way you planned, which is scary.
I'm such a believer in this, because what the lesson that I talk about in this was, I was creating marketing materials to college art department chairs, because I thought I wanted to speak to them about turning their passion into businesses. And so I went through the whole process. I was in a mentor program for the National Speakers Association. So what happened was, you know, I would go week after week to this group, and I became very friendly with the woman who was in charge of the mentor program. And she saw me go through the process. She saw my great marketing materials. She saw me deal with rejection and move on. And somebody else in the National Speakers Association said, you know what, I'm looking for speakers on the subject of marketing. Do you know anybody? And she referred me. This woman had a contract with Staples, the Office Superstore, to give talks on marketing to clients, to customers at Staples all over the country. So we went to new store openings all over the United States. And so while I was trying to pursue art department chairs, somebody else was noticing what I was doing and tapped me on the shoulder for another opportunity. So the lesson is really be in the spirit of what it is you're doing, and then somebody else will find you if the particular opportunity you're pursuing doesn't work out.
I think that that's probably for all of us, that's just so hard. You know, it's hard to open yourself up to those possibilities when if you've written down a business plan, you sort of feel like you're going in one direction, and then to take that step back and say, well, something keeps pushing me to the left.
It's really getting noticed for what you do. And, you know, when somebody is enthusiastic about something, they're like a magnet. If you see somebody working at whatever it is, there's energy that's being put out, and that's a force of nature. So people see you, either you're sending out emails or you're, you know, going for samples or you're, you know, excitedly talking about things. It's really just energy. And so it's really talking about being so passionate about what you're doing, we come back to passion again, that you get picked up for, you know, for whatever it is, and it may not be in the area that you were thinking. So whatever is in your business plan, do it like with your whole heart, your whole enthusiasm, everything. And it may not work out, but chances are something else will come from that. You'll meet somebody at the D&D building or on the way, but your enthusiasm will attract attention.
And I think that's, blogging is a perfect example of that. I think that every one of us will say, I mean, the fact that the three of us, Joni, Linda, and myself, are sitting here over a year later still doing this show, and we've gotten the opportunity to speak to so many really amazing people, I mean, that's all from blogging.
So you're putting it out there and people are seeing it. And it's always when you're not paying attention that some opportunity just comes in that you weren't expecting, but it's perfectly suited for you.
I think we need to get our hands off of it sometimes and be sort of distracted so that the real stuff can happen.
It's the old, you know, the watched pot never boils. So you have to, you know, move away from the kitchen for a while and do something else and then come back. But it's, you know, that's one of the things I do in this book, and one of the reasons I put out the new edition is that self-care is so important. And I think in this economy and what's happening in our world today, mostly you have to take care of yourself so that you can beef yourself up to deal with the trials and tribulations of this very difficult time that we're living in now. So take time for yourself, schedule time to do nothing, get massages, walk away from the office, you know, take really good care of yourself.
I like how you refer to it as taking care of the golden goose.
That's right.
And you are your golden goose.
You are definitely your golden goose. And what I realized, you know, at a pretty early age, probably 19 or 20, was that once I moved out of the house, nobody was saying, Jane, you really ought to sign up for this. Jane, have you looked into that? You know, the job my mother used to have of making sure I was on task. You know, once I was out of the house, it was like, woohoo, she's gone. You know, we don't have to do that anymore. But I had to take it on for myself because nobody was saying, did you notice this opportunity over here? It really behooves us to do that for ourselves.
And if you don't, there's always going to be somebody else out there who will. So it's sort of like, how hungry are you? That's what I used to tell myself. How hungry are you?
Yeah. Well, with goals, if you're not setting your own, then you're going to be working on somebody else's.
And I think we've all had the experience of having had an idea but not doing anything about it. Then all of a sudden you see someone else has made a huge success out of the same idea.
Yes.
And you want to kill it.
We always call that the blinkers and the doers. There are people who have those great ideas and they just sit there and they go, wouldn't that be great? And they blink. And then there are those who are like, yeah, that's a great idea. In fact, you know what? Step one, here, I'm going to do it. But, you know, before you know it, baby step after baby step, they've done exactly what you had thought of.
Yeah, that's one of my lessons. I was in Barnes & Noble one day and I bumped into a friend and, you know, I was telling her, I was researching something. She said, oh, I want to open center. And I said, oh, you know, what are you doing towards that? And it's like, oh, no, I just want to open up. You know, like not taking any action. So, and, you know, she's probably the kind of person who would say, oh, somebody else did it, you know. Like, of course they did it. You didn't have a plan. You got to have a plan. Get into action, right. Jump into the river.
I was going to end with the last lesson, 101, which is success is enjoying what you've worked hard to get and recognizing that you're there. And how do you know? If you're gauging, depending on how you're gauging it, it's so hard to know.
You know, there was a Woody Allen movie once called Stardust Express or Stardust.
That's my favorite one.
You know, there's the subway car, and he's on the subway car with the derelicts and the depressed people and the, you know, the homeless and all that. And he looks over and he sees the subway car with, you know, it looks like a New Year's Eve party and people in, you know, elegant gowns and drinking champagne. And for me, success is being so happy in what you're doing that you're not looking over your shoulder, you're not caring what anybody else is doing. And if you can do that on a daily basis, I don't care how much money anybody else is making, I don't care how happy they are. If I'm happy doing what I'm doing, that's success. And I think it's really taking stock on a regular basis and saying, how is my day going today? Am I in control of it? Do I enjoy the people I'm working with? That's success.
Jane, that is so true, because when you look at the opposite, when someone has jealousy toward you or you know, or you at least, or if there's ever a time when I start feeling that kind of, you know, gritchy kind of feeling like, oh, I feel a little jealous, not envious, but that kind of, you have to re-examine yourself and go, what am I not happy about? I've got everything I need. You know, my life is this way. And I always feel that when people act out of jealousy, I always think, God, I feel bad for them. They're not happy.
Yeah. Sometimes jealousy can, you know, tell you what it is you still want in your life.
Yes.
But on a daily basis is, you know, I jump out of bed in the morning. I love what my life has come to. And I think that's, you know, that's the measure of success. And also taking the time to say, to not be so busy, to say, this is, that's part of my value, is to keep my life simple. It's like, I love every day, because it really
Or if something isn't going your way, I guess, is what I was trying to say. It's wise to stop and say, you know, then what can I do about it? You know,
exactly.
What can I do about it, and how can I get into action? And then maybe it's back to where you were, what you were saying, which was, you know, starting by writing down what your goals are and your values behind those goals.
I think so many people are striving towards somebody else's vision for them, you know, and you've heard the expression, you know, having your ladder up against, your ladder of success up against the wrong wall. You know, you get to the top and you say, ugh, you know, this wasn't what I wanted. And the question in coaching is, what do you really want? And I think that's, you know, a lot of people don't even know how to answer that question. So I feel very lucky that not only do I know how, but that I've achieved it. And it's not, you know, it's not a bottom line, because I know people who make 10 times what I make who are miserable. So what good is that? You know, I have a family that I love, and I have work that I love, and I'm profitable. That's, you know, that's success.
So Jane, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Great to get to know you.
I think you gave us a lot, you know, everyone a lot of food for thought. On your
I was going to say the same thing, Linda, food for thought. Yeah. That was so funny.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Thanks,
okay.
Jane.
Okay, good night.
This has been the Skirted Roundtable with Megan Arquette from Beach Bungalow 8, Joni Webb from Cote to Texas, and I'm Linda Merrill from Surroundings. And this week we were joined by author Jane Pollock, whose book, Sole Proprietor, 101 Lessons of a Lifestyle Entrepreneur, has just been re-released. Thank you so much for joining us. You can visit us online at skirtedroundtable.blogspot.com or download our podcasts from iTunes. Thanks again, and we'll be back soon.